Kadim ibn Abu Bakr and Herminius Kurtz, that unlikely couple, stood on a rocky eminence and looked across the open ground towards the southern ramparts of the city. Their staff were gathered around them, among them the Turkish officers whose authority they had usurped when Zayn al-Din had promoted them. They watched the assault troops moving forward in three columns of 200 men each. They carried the scaling ladders, and on their shoulders were strapped the round bronze targes to defend them against the missiles that would rain down on them from the walls as soon as they were within range. Close behind them, in massed quarter columns, followed the battalions that would surge forward to exploit any foothold they won on the parapets. "It is worth the risk of losing a few hundred men against a chance of a quick break-in," Kurtz said. "We can afford the loss," Kadim agreed. "The rest of the fleet will arrive within days. Another 10,000 men. If we fail today, we can begin the formal siege works on the morrow."
"You must prevail on your reverend uncle, the Caliph, to bring his warships around to begin the blockade of Debay and the harbour."
"He will give the order as soon as he has seen the outcome of this first assault," Kadim assured the Dutchman. "Have faith, General. My uncle is a seasoned commander. He has been waging war on his enemies since the day he ascended the elephant throne. The treacherous revolution of these pork-eating swine we see before us," he pointed to the lines of defenders on the city wall, "was the only defeat he has ever suffered, through treason and betrayal within his own court. It will not happen again."
"The Caliph is a great man. I never said different," Kurtz assured him hastily. "We shall hang those traitors by their own entrails on the walls of the city."
"With God's favour, thanks be to God," Kadim intoned.
The first tenuous bond between them had been tempered to steel links over the 2 years they had been together. That terrible journey forced upon them after they were routed by Jim Courtney in the disastrous night attack was one that lesser men could not have survived. They had braved disease and starvation across thousands of leagues of wild country. Their horses died of sickness and exhaustion or had been killed by hostile tribesmen. They had covered the last stages on foot through swamps and mangrove forests before they reached the coast again. There they had come across a fishing village. They attacked it in the night and slaughtered all the men and children at once. But they killed the five women and the three little girls only after Kurtz and Odoman had expended their pent-up lust on them. Kadim Ibn Abu Bakr had kept aloof from this orgy. He had prayed upon the beach while the women screamed and sobbed, then gave one last shriek as Kurtz and Odoman slit their throats. They had embarked in the captured fishing boats that were nothing more than ancient dilapidated outrigger canoes. After another arduous journey, they at last reached Lamu Harbour. There they prostrated themselves before Zayn al-Din in the throne room of his palace. Zayn al-Din had welcomed his nephew warmly. He had thought him dead, and was delighted by the tidings he brought of Yasmini's execution. As Kadim had promised, the Caliph looked with favour on Kadim's new companion, and listened to accounts of his ruthless warlike talents with attention. As a trial, he had sent Kurtz with a small force to subdue the remaining strongholds of the rebels, who still held out upon the African mainland. He expected him to fail, as all the others before him had done. However, true to his reputation, within 2 months, Kurtz had brought all the ringleaders back to Lamu in chains. There, with his own hands and in Zayn's royal presence, he had disemboweled them alive. As his reward, Zayn gave him half a lakh of gold rupees from the plunder and his pick of the female slaves he had captured. Then he had promoted him to general and given him command of 4 battalions of the army that he was assembling to attack Muscat. "The Caliph comes to us now. As soon as he arrives, you can order the assault to begin." Kadim turned and went to meet the palanquin that 8 slaves were carrying up the hill. It was covered with a sun canopy of gold and blue, and when they set it down, Zayn al-Din stepped out. He was no longer the chubby child whom Dorian had thrashed in the harem on Lamu Island, and whose foot he had maimed in the struggle to protect Yasmini from the torments Zayn had heaped upon her. He still limped, but the puppy fat had fallen away long ago from his frame. A lifetime of intrigue and constant strife had hardened his features,
as it had sharpened his wits. His eyes were quick and acquisitive, his manner imperious. If it were not for the cruel lines of his mouth and the fierce cunning in his dark eyes, he might have been handsome. Kadam and Kurtz prostrated themselves before him. In the beginning, Kurtz had found this form of respect abhorrent. However, like the oriental attire he had adopted, it had become part of his new existence. Zayn gestured to his two generals to rise. They followed him to the brow of the hill and looked down over the open ground on which the assault force was drawn up. Zayn studied the dispositions of the troops with a practiced eye. Then he nodded. "Proceed!" His voice was high-pitched, almost girlish. When he had first heard it, Kurtz had despised Zayn for it, but the voice was the only feminine thing about him. He had fathered 123 children, and only 16 were girls. He had slain his enemies in thousands, many with his own sword. "One red rocket," Kurtz nodded to his aide-de-camp. Swiftly the order was relayed down the back slope of the hill to the signallers. The rocket sparkled like a ruby as it rose into the cloudless sky on a long silver tail of smoke. From the foot of the hill they heard faint cheering, and the massed troops swarmed forward towards the walls. A slave stood in front of Zayn, who rested his long brass telescope on the man's shoulder, using him as a living bipod. The leading ranks of Turks had reached the ditch below the walls when suddenly the sprite came into view from behind the stone ramparts. She was followed almost immediately by the Revenge. Zayn and the officers switched their telescopes to the two ships. "Those are the ships in which the traitor Al-Salil arrived in Muscat," snapped Kadam. "Our spies warned us of their presence." Zayn said nothing, but his features altered at the mention of the name. He felt a stab of pain in his crippled foot, and the acid taste of hatred rose in the back of his throat. "Der guns are run out," Kurtz stared at them through the glass. "They have our battalions in enfilade. Send a galloper to warn them," he snarled at his aide-de-camp. "We have no horses," the man reminded him. "Go yourself," Kurtz seized his shoulder and shoved him away down the slope. "Run, you useless dog, or I shall have you shot from a cannon's mouth." His Arabic was becoming more fluent every day. The man raced away down the slope, shouting, waving his arms, and pointing towards the small squadron of warships. However, the Turks were fully launched upon the attack, and none looked back. "Signal the recall," Kadam suggested. But they all knew it was too late for that. They watched in silence. Suddenly, the leading ship erupted in a cloud of white powder smoke. She heeled slightly to the broadside of her long black cannons, then came back on even keel, but her hull was blotted out by the billowing smoke cloud. Only her masts showed high above it. The thunderous sound of the blast reached their ears only seconds after the discharge, then rolled away in diminishing echoes among the distant hills. The watchers on the hilltop turned their telescopes back to the dense pack of humanity on the place below. The havoc shocked even these old soldiers, who were hardened to the carnage of the battlefield. The grape shot spread so that each blast cut a swathe 20 paces wide through the massed battalions, like the scythe blade through a field of ripe wheat. It left not a single one standing in its path. Chainmail and bronze armour offered the same protection as a sheet of brittle parchment. Severed heads, bearded and still wearing their soup bowl helmets, were tossed into the air. Torsos with arms and legs torn off were piled upon each other. The cries of the dying and wounded carried clearly to the men on the hilltop. The Sprite put up her helm and tacked round into the open waters of the bay. The Revenge sailed serenely into her place. On shore the survivors stood in stunned dismay, unable to fathom the extent of the disaster that had swept through their ranks. As the Revenge levelled her cannon on them, the moans of the wounded were drowned out by the survivors' wails of despair. Few had the presence of mind to throw themselves flat against the earth. They dropped the scaling ladders, turned their backs on the menace of the guns, and ran. The Revenge loosed her broadside upon them. Her shot swept the field. She put up her helm and followed her sister ship around. The Sprite completed her tack across the wind, then came back on the other leg, offering her port battery to the fleeing Turks. Meanwhile, her starboard battery had reloaded with canvas bags of grape,
and the gunners were standing ready to take their next turn. Like dancers performing a stately minuet, the two ships went through a series of elaborate figures of eight. Each time their guns bore, they loosed another thunderclap of smoke, flame, and cast-iron grapeshot across the narrow strip of open water. After the Sprite had completed her second pass, Mansair snapped his telescope shut and told Kumra, "There is nothing more to fire at. Run in the guns, take her out into the bay." The two ships sailed back blithely to their anchorage under the protection of the guns on the parapets of the city walls. Zayn and his two generals surveyed the field. Corpses littered the ground, thick as autumn leaves.
"How many?"
asked Zayn, in his high, girlish voice.
"Not more than 300, Kadum hazarded.
"No, no, fewer," Kuitz shook his head. 150. 200 at the most."
"They are only Turks, and another 100 dhows full of them will arrive before the week is out,"
Zayn nodded dispassionately.
"We must begin digging the approach trenches and throw up a wall of gabions filled with sand along the bayside to protect our men from the ships."
"Will your Majesty order the fleet to take up a blockading station across the entrance to the bay?"
Kadum asked respectfully. "We must bottle up those two ships of Al-Salil and at the same time prevent supplies of food reaching the city by sea."
"The orders have already been given," Zayn told him loftily. "The English consul will place his own ship at the head of the fleet. His is the only vessel to match those of the enemy for speed. Sir Guy will prevent them breaking out through our blockade and escaping to the open ocean."
"Al-Salil and his bastard must not be allowed to escape," Kadum's eyes lit with the dark mesmeric glare as he said the name.
"My own hatred for him exceeds yours. Abu Bakr was my brother and Al-Salil murdered him. There are other old scores, too, almost as compelling, which I still have to settle with him," Zayn reminded him. "Despite this setback, we have the noose around his neck. Now we will draw it tight."